And the audio is ready. We have some Zoom participation. Okay, let's get going. Let's call the meeting to order and check for our quorum. Mr. Kwolek, could you please take the roll call?
Thank you, Chair Beal. Roll call, Advisory Board Member Ingraffia.
Yes.
Advisory Board Member Goldman.
Here.
Advisory Board Member Irwin.
Here.
Advisory Board Member Gaffney.
Here.
Advisory Board Member Nava.
Here.
Chair Rogers is absent, and Acting Chair Beal.
Present. Thank you.
Thank you. We have quorum.
The meeting is called to order. It's 5:31. We're going to start with a moment of silence, beginning now. Thank you. And now would one of the board members care to lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance today? Thank you, Jan. Before we begin, do any of the PWAB members have any announcements that they would like to make? No, seeing none, does staff have any announcements?
Yes. Eric, do you want to make an announcement?
I believe this is, we have one announcement in regards to additional storm damage. It was found yesterday on the Embarcadero on the southbound side that there was some pavement failure and what was discovered to be a void under the pavement. So we have hired a contractor to open up the area, and then we sent a camera in today and found that the void extends into the northbound side. So we're going to be repairing the entire storm drain that crosses Embarcadero. So there will be some disruptive, some disruption to traffic as a result. But it'll be, the work will be performed over the next couple of days. So we're seeing these storm drain issues in many parts of the city. Sequoia Court to be is another that we've had to block off an area of the street. So we'll be addressing that one at some point. Of course, the board is probably aware of the Elena project that is currently in progress, where we're repairing a storm drain that failed a number of years ago. So that project has just started this week. So that's an update on storm-related issues as of this week.
Thank you, City Engineer Riddio. Perhaps we could talk a bit more about that during the department highlights section, since this is only announcements and not meant for deliberation. I would add one announcement that members of the public are invited to the Water Resources Center open house. After many years of discussion, after a couple of years of construction, the Water Resources Center is now open. It is fully treating all wastewater from the city as required by the permit. This open house will take place on Thursday, February 23rd, which is next week. I've just passed out flyers to everyone here in the building. There's also information about it on our website. The open house will begin at 1 p.m. and end at 4 p.m. If you'd like a tour of the wharf, please RSVP through the website, or I think there's a QR code on the notice. If you can't do that or not sure how to do that, you can also just come, but we really would like you to RSVP so we have an idea how many folks are coming. The idea behind the event is that it's designed to be family friendly. I realize many families can't come during that time because of the time of day. However, if you are interested in having a tour of the Water Resources Center and can't make it on the 23rd, it will not be the final tour that we ever do. So please let us know and we can set something up for a later date. Thank you.
Any other staff announcements? Okay.
And I'm sorry, Chair Beal, we missed one, and I think I gave you an agenda with an error on it. We have to elect the chair and vice chair for this year. That's typically something we do at this meeting. So at this point, I would ask if there's any nominations for chair. I did talk to Doug, who's our current chair, and he said he didn't want to be chair again this year, but he wanted to remain on the advisory board. So with that said, we'd be seeking nominations for chair and vice chair.
Then I'll nominate John Irwin for chair. He's been on the board for several years.
This is going to be interesting.
Are there any other nominations for chair?
I'd like to nominate Lori. She's done a great job acting.
Thank you.
Okay, we have two nominations. Would anyone like to nominate anyone else for chair? Okay, and John and Lori, are both of you interested in serving as chair for this year, or is one person not really interested?
I would be happy to if that is the desire.
I'm not sure I have the social skills to be a chairman, but if you wanted me to, I'd consider it maybe as a vice chair this time.
Okay. Can someone on the advisory board make a motion to appoint the chair and vice chair, and we'll need that seconded and then a roll call vote to follow?
I'd like to move that we, excuse me, have Lori Beal as our chair and John Irwin as our vice chair.
A second by Advisory Board Member Gaffney. Roll call vote. Advisory Board Member Ingrafia?
An enthusiastic yes.
Thank you for that. Advisory Board Member Goldman?
Yes.
Advisory Board Member Irwin?
Yes.
Advisory Board Member Gaffney? Advisory Board Member Nava?
Yes.
And Chair Beal?
Yes.
Okay.
Sorry, John.
Unanimous.
You're going to be great.
Congratulations. Lori, you're now chair of this meeting, which you already were.
Okay. Well, thank you. Let's move on to public comment. If you have comments that are related to items in the agenda, please hold those till we get to the agenda items. However, if there is anything not in the agenda that anyone in the public would like to comment on, you are welcome to do that at this time. We'll start with anyone here present in the audience that would like to come to the podium. Seeing no public comment, do we have participation over Zoom at this time?
There are no raised hands at this time.
Okay. Thank you. Then we will move on to our business items. Item A1 is approval of the minutes for the November 16th, 2022 board meeting.
Thank you, Chair Beal. And before there's a motion to approve, I'd just like to note that one of our constituents has pointed out a clerical error on the November minutes, which is item A1, that Jim Kernett's name was misspelled. And so for the record, we are making that correction. And the whoever motions can make a motion to approve as amended with that correction.
So with that correction, would any board members like to have any discussion or make a motion to approve the minutes?
I move to approve the minutes as corrected.
Would someone like to second?
Second.
Thank you.
And roll call vote. Advisory Board Member Ingraffia?
Yes.
Advisory Board Member Goldman?
Yes.
Advisory Board Member Irwin?
Yes.
Advisory Board Member Gaffney?
Yes.
Advisory Board Member Nava?
Yes.
Chair Beal?
Yes. Thank you. Now we're on agenda item A2, the meeting minutes for October.
And thank you, Chair Beal. Once again, a constituent has notified us of misspelling of a name on the October minutes. That was Mr. Barry Brannon's name was misspelled. It will be corrected for the record, and I would ask that any motion made about these minutes include that correction.
Any discussion from the board? Would someone like to make a motion?
And I'm sorry, Chair Beal, we should take public comment for this and for the prior item, if there's any public comment.
So going back to item A1, is there any public comment with respect to those meeting minutes? Either anyone present or who may be attending virtually?
There are no raised hands virtually.
Okay. And then moving again to item A2, any public comments on the October meeting minutes? Either in present or virtually?
There are still no raised hands.
Oh, all right. Now we may proceed with approving item A2 if there is a motion.
I move that we approve item A2 with a correction noted.
I'll second.
Advisory Board Member, Advisory Board Member Ingraffia?
Yes.
Advisory Board Member Goldman?
Yes.
Advisory Board Member Irwin?
Yes.
Advisory Board Member Gaffney?
Yes.
Advisory Board Member Nava?
Yes.
Chair Beal?
Yes. Thank you. Now we can move on to A3, Public Works Department highlights. Do we have a presentation?
Thank you, Chair Beal. We won't go through the entire packet, but I did want to note that the major activities the Public Works Department has been involved in over the last month relate to the historic storms that occurred in early January. First, the Public Works Department participated in the Emergency Operations Center that lasted for about a day, but then continued on with a somewhat regular meeting. And we were, our department was aiding in response to the storm. There was, of course, flooding. The city was cut off on three sides. On one side, the new Water Resources Center was pretty much cut off from everything. And then we had downtown Morro Bay cut off from the south and the north. And then, of course, North Morro Bay was cut off from the south. And that created quite a challenge for the department and the personnel in the department to respond to issues. There were a few downed trees. Most notably, there was a downed tree on Main Street that actually was kind of like hanging on utility lines. That was removed pretty quickly. There was a downed tree on Pacific. In the aftermath of the flood, you know, we found a lot of damage, particularly with storm drains, as City Engineer Riddio mentioned earlier. We already knew that we had two very serious storm drain failures that were resulting in sinkholes on Elena and Sequoia. Since then, since the storms, we've identified at least four more, one off of Quintana Road, one on Embarcadero, I believe one on Main. And one on Embarcadero. I'm sorry, not on Embarcadero, on Atascadero Road.
Atascadero Road near the beach access point.
So as this advisory board knows, there is no ongoing maintenance program for our storm drain system. That is not something that is in the city's budget. One reason for that is, unlike water and sewer, infrastructure, which have their own respective funds to fund regular maintenance. Storm drain maintenance has to be funded either through the general fund and Measure Q and E funds, which are scarce and frankly competitive to get because every department in the city has needs. So we are doing our best to respond and address these failures. However, we hope to either in this next year's budget or in a future budget advocate for regular ongoing maintenance and replacement of the corrugated metal pipe storm drains that we have in the city that are clearly at the end of their useful life and are creating very expensive problems for the city to respond to. Other than that, we're now transitioning into recovery mode, and that means a whole lot of work for the Public Works Department and the Finance Department because we are hoping to recoup mostly money spent, during the emergency and the disaster. We believe that storm-related costs are up to approximately $20 million for the city of Morro Bay. And FEMA has declared an emergency here in San Luis Obispo County, which opens up access for federal emergency monies. The city has not yet submitted an application for public assistance. That application was initially due tomorrow on the 16th of February. However, we just received notification that that deadline is extended 1 month. So the city will have some extra time to do that. That action is essentially pulling a ticket with FEMA, saying, okay, you know, we're going to have a meeting with you guys and get together all of our information. But that hasn't started yet because we have not yet submitted the application. I won't go through anything else in here, but I will take any questions. Advisory Board Member Irwin.
Yeah, and this is not really a question. As I served I've been deployed for some FEMA disaster recovery issues. One of the things which I think we should be involved with is they have what's called hazardous mitigation. And with hazardous mitigation, if you have a project where the damage is caused by the flooding or the disaster, if you do a temporary repair to keep it safe and with a formal project to repair it, you would be allowed to expand that project to address any deficiencies associated, which might have caused it. And so I would strongly suggest that you don't do formal final repairs on things if you're going to look to do repairs. And on the one water plan, has any of those culverts identified in the one water plan been damaged by this flooding?
I don't have an answer to that specific question, partially because, as you know, the one water plan did not evaluate our infrastructure for condition, but for capacity. That's sort of a cross analysis that we would have to do. But I do appreciate your comment, and it is noted about the hazard mitigation funds. We are aware of that, and City Engineer Eric Riddio will note that as well about temporary repairs then being eligible for permanent repairs through federal money.
And the you will be required to do a hydraulic evaluation of any drainage project that you have, and that's going to be reimbursable too, but you're going to have to go through the process. And if you have capacity issues identified in the one water and that facility was damaged during the flooding, that should be eligible for hazard mitigation.
Okay, thank you.
I have a couple questions, and also it's a little premature, but I was going to suggest for our next meeting that we have an agenda item on stormwater so that maybe we don't have to ask all of our questions today, because I'm going to suspect people do have a lot of questions. So just to keep it short on my own behalf, although, as I said, I do have a lot of additional questions, the costs that could be available from FEMA, are those in grants or are those loans that need to be repaid? And then Does the city have a stormwater management plan?
To answer your first question, the money's available would be grants. They would not need to be repaid, but they would not fully cover costs. The state would be I believe it's 75% from the feds, 18.25% from the state, and then six, or maybe it's 18.75 from the state, and then I think 6.25 from the city. I got a thumbs up from Advisory Board Member Irwin, so I got that right. We have what I would call a capital improvement plan for stormwater infrastructure that is based on the One Water Plan. I say that because now that the new sheriffs are in town with me, with myself and city engineer, having been here both for not very long, our concern is that some of the projects identified in the One Water Plan and that made it into our capital improvement plan with some funding in some cases are projects that are building new storm drains in areas that don't have storm drains, which is excellent. However, we don't have money to fix the failing storm drains and the old storm drains that are about to fail. And our philosophy internally, as we've been talking about this issue, is it's probably more important to fix the stuff we have that's breaking than to start building new stuff because the breaks are very expensive. As an example, the Elena storm drain project, had we known that that storm drain was failing, we might have been able to sleeve that storm drain for, I don't know, $50,000 to $100,000 4 years ago, whereas now it's costing $500,000, and due to claims that we're anticipating may cost more than that. So as an example, there was a storm drain project in our capital improvement plan that I believe is down Kern and Anchor. Am I getting a head nod there? That would be to build a new storm drain down Kern, and the reason is capacity issues. Because according to the One Water Plan, every now and then the roundabout may get flooded. Well, we had historic rain, and the roundabout did not get flooded. So we are looking to deprioritize some of those projects, not to eliminate them, but to deprioritize those projects so that we can take care of our degrading system as it stands. And I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, I think it does. And this is a just a small little comment, not a question, and I don't mean it to be argumentative in any manner, but in terms of planning, the idea of historic flood, I think, may not be entirely accurate depending on, you know, how climate change affects us. So I think it's good to think of it as more of a wake-up call than something that happened once and hopefully won't happen for another 100 years.
That's a fair call out. Thank you.
And I'd like to add that one of the things that FEMA will require is if you have to go in and repair it with FEMA funds, they will require you to do a hydraulic capacity study. And if what you're repairing is undersized, they very likely will make you put something of the right size in.
Thank you. Any other questions about the department highlights?
I would just like to add, I suspect from the standpoint of the citizens, it's much easier to substantiate that an existing system of drains will work properly. It's simply the expectation that I see it there, and it should function, so I support what you're saying.
Thank you. And just to echo Chair Beal's comments, if we were to go forward with a recommendation to City Council, we would bring a full discussion about this issue to the PWAP first.
Any other questions from the board? Then at this time, would anyone from the public like to make a comment? And no one here present has indicated an intent to comment. Do we have anyone virtually who would like to comment?
There are no raised hands at this time.
Okay, thank you. Then we can move on to item A4. Do we have a presentation?
Yes, thank you, okay. Chair Beal. This item is for the Water Reclamation Facility Program quarterly report for quarter two of fiscal year 23, and also a presentation of some change orders that will be taken to City Council. It is anticipated on February 28th. And to give that presentation, we have our Water Reclamation Facility Program Manager, Paul Amico, on the line from Carollo Engineering. Paul, are you there?
I am. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul. Paul could not make it in person today. He apologizes for that. But he is fully prepared to make his presentation remotely. And AGP, are we going to be able to put the presentation up? Or Paul will just share screen?
He would need to share screen.
Let me share my screen, see if that works.
Sure. Take it away, Paul.
Thank you.
It's a little blurry, just so you know, but it is coming up.
Okay. So thanks again for the opportunity to present tonight. Again, apologies, I couldn't make it. Unfortunately, a travel schedule got in the way, and I couldn't make it down tonight. I will hopefully make it for future meetings. So as we normally do for the quarterly report updates, I would like to give a construction update first, then we'll go into the quarterly report, which should be pretty concise, before we go into the contract amendments. Apologies, I missed a bullet here. We're going to do Anvil Builders, the amendment number 7, and then we've got a couple of contract amendments that we'd like to discuss with you as well and just get some input on that. So to start with the construction update, we have a very nice drone photo of the Water Resources Center on the right-hand side. It's looks like a plant. So we're very glad to say, as Director Qualick said, that the city has been treating wastewater through the plant, and we are wrapping up some additional testing, tweaking of the wastewater process itself, and preparing for the purified water facility testing, the advanced purification facility testing, which is required by the state. On the conveyance facility side, I don't think it comes as any secret to anybody in the community that we've completed paving over the last couple weeks. I understand, unfortunately, I couldn't be in town, but understand it was quite a scene and a lot of activity. Apologies to the community for the disruption, and appreciate your patience as we got this facility wrapped up. But we're very excited to say that major construction of the conveyance facilities is for the most part complete, and we're getting the fit and finish and the million little details it takes to get the facilities completed, wrapped up, so that we can anticipate full completion by the end of March. Some of the pictures you see here, the picture in the upper left is what we call Pump Station B over by Limos on Main Street. Picture on the bottom is of the tie-in at the what we call the existing air relief structure, or the structure that takes the wastewater out to the ocean, or the treated effluent, I'm sorry, out to the ocean. That's the tie-in for the pipelines there. And then the picture on the right is a deep structure over by Pump Station A on Atascadero Road, new junction structure for pushing the flow into the new pump station and taking it off the old plant. Last two pictures of the conveyance facilities, the pipe bridge on the left was, I always like these pictures. They're quite artistic. Looking down the pipe bridge, at the two force mains and the treated effluent line. And then on the right, we have pump station A. This was taken just the other day. Final paving has been completed at pump station A on Atascadero Road. This is, for the most part, again, complete, in these areas, major construction. Any questions on conveyance facilities construction update before I move on to the WRF?
I have one.
Yes.
I have a question about the fusion welded pipe that's on the shoulder north side of the Quintana Road from South Bay Boulevard up towards Las Tunas. The paving's done, and I'm just curious what that pipe is laying on the side of the road for.
That pipe, actually, I think that pipe has been completely decommissioned. That was the wastewater bypass line. That what that did was lift station 3, which is down at the bottom of Quintana Road and at South Bay Boulevard, collects flow from that local area there. That was tied directly into the new force mains. And while that work was going on, in preparation for that, there was a sewer that was taken out of service. So that needed, that flow needed to be rerouted up to the top of the hill. So that was the sewer bypass. So that was, that pipeline is being removed. So that was temporary in nature, and now it's, it should be removed if it's not already, completely removed by now.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. And Mr. Amico, would you mind, in the interim, emailing me your presentation? You can continue with the presentation for now, but we'd like to get it set up here because it is coming in a bit fuzzy.
Yep, I can definitely do that. Let me, just give me 1 second while I'm talking. I'll try to get that to you. Greg, it might be, it's kind of a large file, so it might be coming, it might come through as a link. So, okay. Next slide, the Water Resources Center. As I had said, the Water Resources Center wastewater component has been completed. That is what the drone photo that we're seeing here is. So the, as we had talked about, I think in the last PWAB meeting, the startup was a little bumpy, to say the least. There've been it was quite exciting over a couple of days, and then it finally got ironed out. We had to actually send flow back to the old plant for several weeks while the wastewater process. We slowly introduced wastewater here, but from the drone photo, you can see the tanks in the middle. Hopefully, it's not too blurry. The tanks in the middle are the biological reactors for the treatment process, which is really the living part of the process. And just to the left of that, on the picture, are the membrane bioreactors or the process that separates the solids from the liquid, and then cleans up the water. So, again, over the last several, over the last couple months, city operations staff and engineers and operations specialists from Black and Veatch have been working closely together to get this process tuned, so that the city can assume long-term operation of the facility and we can say that we have met the city's regulatory compliance deadline with the substantial completion of the Water Resources Center. The last part of the update here is the Water Resources Center substantial completion. This is a contract milestone, and the letter on the left is a letter from the city to Phelan's Black and Veatch telling them that the wastewater component of the plant has been completed and is available for its intended use, meaning in Morro Bay's case that Morro Bay has met the regulatory deadline for treating wastewater and improving effluent quality to the ocean discharge. And what that does at that point is not, does not say that the facility is complete, finally complete, but what it does at that point is requires collaborative agreement on all the remaining work items, what we refer to as the punch list. And that final agreement on the punch list will trigger what we call a retainage release or a retention release. And for anyone who doesn't really know what that is, what we do is we retain 5% of every invoice that construction contractors submit to us. And what that does is hold some of their money so that we can make sure that they can they finish the job complete the remaining work items. The specific amount that we will release of that retention is negotiated with the contractor, in this case, Phelan's Black and Veatch, based on those punch list items. So,
and Mr. Amico, we were able to pull up your presentation, so we're going to switch you off.
Okay.
And you'll just let Janine know when to change slides. So we are on the Water Resources Center substantial completion slide. Is that where you were?
That's where I was.
Okay, we're there.
All right, thanks for your patience. Again, technology is great. We were able to make that switch pretty easily. So any questions on substantial completion before I move into the quarterly report update? That concluded the construction update on both the conveyance and Water Resources Center. Any questions on substantial completion on any of the construction updates?
Council, I'm sorry, Advisory Board Member Irwin.
Yes, I was wondering, there is a cost, you know, if the Black and Veatch brought the work under budget, that there would be a sharing of savings between the city and Black and Veatch. Do we have an estimate of roughly how that much that's going to be?
So the contract is for a $4 million. If they bring in the Water Resources Center $4 million or more under contract, the city and Black and Veatch split the savings, and those savings don't exceed. In other words, there's no more than $4 million. If they bring it under $5 million under, then the city and Black and Veatch split $4 million, right? So for Black and Veatch's incentive is $2 million. At this point in time, we have about $5 million remaining in spending in the contract, not spending, $5 million remaining in the contract, and they still have work to do. So we don't currently have a projection from Feelants Black and Veatch on what they, on that, whether that savings will be achieved, but we've gotten indications that they're obviously very interested in achieving those savings and getting their incentive payment. So I'm hoping that answers your question. We still have work to do on the, we still have work to do on the purified water facility, and there's still have quite a bit of work to do on the punch list. Some of it, you know, significant, and other stuff is not as significant, but we're working with them on a daily basis. And in fact, I was just talking with Damaris today about the punch list and trying to figure out when we can get through all of the items so we can sit down and agree on that and just keep moving the project forward. Our aim would be to, again, complete the work by the end of March, but the DDW testing would be, is going to go out, potentially into May. And so we continue to work with them on a daily basis on their schedule and trying to get the project done.
Thank you. I'm going to have a similar question for Andel, the contract, too.
Okay. Would you like to ask that now, or will you want to wait until the amendment?
Whichever is appropriate to you. I'm just curious. It looks like there will be any cost savings on the Andel contract.
That contract is not structured in that way. The contract for Anvil was a design, what we call design bid build delivery method. So it was a public bid, and it's a unit price contract. So the unit, you know, the quantities that were bid, if they install those quantities, if they're under on the quantities in any way, then they you know, they just don't get paid for all the quantities. And if they're over, then we have to do a final balancing change order that balances everything out. So at this point in time, as you'll see tonight, there's a change order or another amendment that includes several change orders. And then we have several additional change orders that we weren't able to get through all the negotiation on. So we will be bringing some additional change orders to the both PWAB and council as we close out that construction contract. And then do the final completion and the substantial completion. So there'll be one final amendment that kind of settles everything at the end.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions before I move on to the quarterly report? Okay, hearing none, we can go to the next slide. Okay. Wanted to talk a little bit about the bike path. I know everyone in the community is keen to get that bike path back open, as are we. So the restoration, the grading and bike path paving have been completed south of the Pipe Bridge or south of Morrow Creek. Obviously, with the rainfall, the significant rainfall we received, that left the bike path quite a mess. That area is subject to flooding. A lot of the grading that was done around there helped with some of that flooding, but again, due to the large amount of rain and the that was received in the flooding, it did leave quite a mess. So Anvil's been cleaning that up, and so the paved path was placed back in its original location, even though we did get the 70-foot easement from PG&E and Vistra. That opens that bike path back up to, or opens it up to additional restoration that can be done. The area west of the path will be kept clear for future injection well construction, and that would mean that during that path, during that construction, we wouldn't have to close the path during that construction, but could keep it open and isolate construction traffic on that side. The long-term landscape plan design is being finalized as we speak, and we've been asked, I think, in past council meetings to bring that forward for a discussion at council and at PWAB so that, that people can provide input to that plan. Haven't discussed the specifics around when we do that with Mr. Kralik or Mr. Riddio at this point, but we're getting close on that plan. Right now, the current focus on the plan is to replace the trees that were removed during construction, and then to seed that entire area with the final restoration completed once the recycled water component of the program gets constructed and the injection wells. You can do the next slide if you don't mind. So the plan as it stands, I think I had a slide in one of the past PWAB presentations for the landscape plan, hasn't changed much. The overall look and feel of that area will be finalized in the future with the shrubbery and other features being being brought forward again for in a meeting to discuss those. And initially to complete the pipeline project, we'll do tree replacement and seeding to green it up again and get it open for everyone to use. Any questions on the bike path?
I have a comment.
Mm-hmm.
FEMA does not provide reimbursement for recovery or repair for any project under the control of a contractor, so I don't think you can expect any money. The city can't expect any money for any damages to the bike path due to the flooding.
Thank you. That's an interesting comment because that may be a different conclusion at the wharf plant. Anyway,
the wharf plant you've taken control of, so that's. That's another issue, but for things you have not taken control of, FEMA's sticky about saying they will not fund repairs to those things. That's the contractor's responsibility.
Thank you. That's good information.
Yeah, really appreciate that. The bike path did hold up pretty well. It was just pretty dirty afterwards. So the area north of Morrow Creek got quite inundated with mud, so Anvil does have to clean that area up. But that portion of the bike path would only had minor cosmetic damage from the construction that Anvil will be repairing. So the area south, that bike path was, that's the area we're talking about, south of the creek between Main Street and the creek. Any further questions on the bike path before we get into the quarterly report?
Did you cover the contract for Rincon?
Mr. Heimel will help me with that part at the end of the presentation. That'll be after the quarterly report update, which will be brief, and then the discussion of the change orders for Anvil.
I see. Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, next slide. Quarterly report update. As we do every quarter, we receive data from the prior quarter. In this case, it was data received from the city for the period ending December 31st, end of the year. So that's the second fiscal quarter. The total spending through the second quarter for the overall program is $128.8 million, against a budget of $159.8 million at this point in time, the current approved budget. And that's through the quarter two. We historically, as we presented in the report, and we can go to the next slide if you don't mind. As we present in the quarterly report, we present schedule, accomplishments, challenges, costs. Schedule, as I always like to say, is king here, and you can see that We're nearing the milestones for the water reclamation facility, which has now been renamed the Water Resources Center, and the conveyance facilities. We're getting close on those. Hope to, again, aiming to complete the conveyance facilities, fully complete those by the end of March, and have Anvil demobilized from town, and then the Water Resources Center still working through the specific schedule with the Division of Drinking Water on the testing of the purified water, the advanced purification facilities. And then recycled water facilities, my colleague Mr. Heimel has taken over management of those, much more specific management of those. So if any questions on the recycled water facilities facilities, then Dan would have to answer those. Any questions on our schedule that was presented in the report?
What page do we find this figure?
Thank you for asking that. I will find that as we're going through. It'd be great if somebody had a question on the recycled water facilities, then I could find what page that was on.
Page 6 for program-wide.
Thank you.
There's a table of contents in the beginning of the packet that shows all the figures and where they are.
Yeah, the figure I've got has been cut off.
That's because, and I appreciate that, that's because when we print these, I believe that schedule is at like a...
probably 11 by 17.
Right, an 11 by 17, and so it wasn't printed to the correct proportion with that. But it is available for anyone who's looking at it online or who looks at the packet on our website.
Any questions on schedule? And that would, and again, I generally try to keep the remarks on the quarterly report brief to open it up for any questions. We'll move into the amendments next. Okay, amendment number 7 for Anvil Builders includes 7 change orders, total of $124,700 in for the amendment. Apologies for this getting slid over at the last minute. I wanted to add a picture for illustration of one of the items, and I didn't slide it back to the middle. The first item, and I'll take these one by one if y'all don't mind, and I'll stop for each, and I can answer any questions on any specific one. As we go, there is a picture on the following page on number 75, and we'll go flip to that when I get to that one and then come back. So PC over number 5, pump station A excavation and PDS dewatering permit. And PDS stands for National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System, and it is the surface water discharge permit that the city holds for both the wastewater treatment plant treated effluent discharge to the ocean, and then also any discharges to surface waters need to be permitted through the regional board. In this particular case, for pump station A, which is the pump station on Atascadero Road, there was a deep excavation to construct that pump station that required dewatering. I'm sure you can imagine that you're that close to the ocean and sandy soils, you're going to have high groundwater. Anvil, when we were originally in the design phase, we anticipated we could discharge that excavation water through the old wastewater treatment facility. And during construction, once we saw the specific plan for dewatering, it was much, much more flow than operations staff felt that facility could take at the time. And so we worked with Anvil and the regional board to get a discharge permit for the dewatering water to discharge it through an existing outfall or a pipe that goes to the ocean over by the rock. And that required much more extensive testing and sampling program than Anvil had put into their bid with the original location going to the plant. And so this $55,856 change order is for the additional sampling and testing and the work to collect the samples and all of the work associated with that. It's a bit of an old change order, as you can see, PC05 as compared to some of the higher numbers here. And this just took Anvil a while to get all their invoices in and get all the final analysis and everything to us that was required. So it's quite an old change order, but they finally got all the pricing to us. This had been previously, this particular one had previously been discussed with WRF subcommittee, and they were authorized to move forward with this work long ago, actually. And now this is just the final cost for it. Any questions on that one?
Yeah, Paul, I have a question. Could you characterize the delay, the duration for the sampling? I'm just curious as to what the time span was for sampling and testing and the rental of the shoring and piping materials.
Right. So that's a great question. It seemed like it was a long time. So the shoring rental and a lot of the physical infrastructure that was included with that, the pumps and the wells and the shoring, and that was included in the original bid. This is just simply for the sampling of the discharge water and the lab work and then the reporting. So that was done over a period. They ran the dewatering system for probably close to a year before they were up and out of the ground and didn't have to have the dewatering system in. I don't remember the exact duration, but it was a year or more that they had to run that.
All right. Thank you, because I was wondering if it was a short period. Apparently, it was a very long period. Thank you.
Yeah, it was very long, actually, that they were out there. Okay, next item here, PCO 8.2, additional project signage costs. As you can see, it's 8.2. We already had one of the original bid, I think, included an allowance of $5,000 for signage that we didn't otherwise identify in the traffic plans that was required or that wouldn't be required by the traffic plans. This would be special signage for, specific construction zones or businesses open during construction signs, those types of signs. And so the original $5,000 signage budget was depleted, and we've actually had issued, I don't remember what piece the first allowance increase was. It was around $3,000, and then there's another $3,500 for signage as the project has gone on. So this spans the entire close to 2 years that that Anvil was on site, and this would be for the signage, a lot of the signage that was along Quintana during the time when we were out there, when the road was really rough, and additional businesses open signs, et cetera. So that's an additional $3,500 for that. And these signage costs were generally directed by the city and the city staff, meaning our construction management team, and we would concur with Public Works and with WRF subcommittee and others about where, what additional signage we might need. A lot of it through a lot of public input as well. We would look at certain areas and then say we needed more signs, and then we'd hear from members of the public that felt that things weren't clear or whatever. So we would add, we made sure there was ample signage around town. Any questions on this one? Okay. Hearing none, we will move forward. So PCO 23.1, this is part two of miscellaneous unforeseen utility work. I think the first round for this one, we've talked about this in the past, is when we have either unclear, mismarked utilities that weren't physically located where the records said they were, or we run into unknown utilities. The city's on the hook to reimburse Anvil for additional effort to either deal with those utilities, slow production rates, different elements around unforeseen utility work. At this one, this particular one, as we said in the staff report, there was some additional minimum cover determination. There was I think this one was driven by DDW requirements, Division of Drinking Water requirements, in that, and so there was standby time while we tried to figure that one out. Unknown underground utilities by SoCalGas, ones that SoCalGas had to come out and identify as theirs. And then there was a waterline, 2-inch waterline broken by Anvil on Kennedy Way around that. And there were some unclear costs, whether Anvil was on the hook for them or, you know, this would be on the city. And in that particular case, I believe that due to the unclear nature of that particular water line, we negotiated this price from Anvil from an initial ask that was much higher. So we negotiated that down to get it to the overall item here. If I don't have a specific breakdown of how these particular ones break out in the $17,000, but if we think that's of interest, I can certainly follow up on that.
Did any of the unmarked utilities come from the fact that the utilities maps were incomplete and that's what the designer relied on, or is it some other issue?
In these specific ones, these were probably a combination of incomplete. I don't think any of these were from incomplete mapping as I look at these. These were ones that just weren't marked, and they came up, like particularly the one from number two, you know, unknown underground utilities. So they're digging along, and they find something that nobody knew about. And so I think the SoCalGas standby, you know, had us stop and investigate those in a more thorough manner. And so in these particular ones, none of these were from unclear mapping or inaccurate mapping. It does happen quite a bit, though.
I know.
So PCO 66 and 80 are pretty related. They're pretty similar leaking water lines. One was at the pipe bridge, and then the other one was at the pump station A site. These were ones where Anvil was working in the area, observed water coming out of the ground, and notified city staff. And then because Anvil had these work zones and it would be unsafe for city crews and inefficient for city crews to come in and make these repairs, we requested Anvil to do the repairs. And so determined that they weren't broken by Anvil. These were unrelated to the work. And had Anvil fix these. So 66 is about $11,000 for that work. And then number 80 was about $4,500 for fixing some existing water lines that that were leaking in their work zone. Okay, hearing no questions on those two. PG&E Bollards. Janine, if you don't mind flipping to the next slide and then flipping back once we, while I talk about this one. Okay, so the PG&E Bollards, if you can see in the upper left portion of this this picture, this is pump station A. When PG&E set the transformer, the original design, as it was agreed upon by PG&E, and the designer had fewer bollards in the area. The bollards are those yellow posts that go around the transformer. And so, you know, perhaps they had four. I don't remember the exact number, but now you can see there's a sea of bollards out there, and those were required by PG&E after the construction contract had been let to Anvil. And so after the transformer was placed, they requested additional bollards to be placed in the area to protect those transformers. And so in this case, and Janine, if you don't mind flipping back to the other one, the prior slide, this one's $15,000 for additional PG&E bollards, and this is at both the pump stations. So if there are no questions on this, I'll go to number 78, and then I can wrap it up for overall questions about change orders if there are none on this one. So 78 is an interesting one. The piping, the change to stainless steel was driven. There are some pipes that exist at both pump stations that are there to drain water from the discharge piping back into the wet well when the pumps are not operating, when the pumps shut off. And during some commissioning testing, some pretty extreme commissioning testing. One of the PVC pipes broke. They're made out of PVC plastic Schedule 40, which should, under normal operating circumstances, take the pressures and the loads that were placed on it. And some during some failure testing, one of the PVC lines broke, and between city operations staff and the designer, concluded that it would be better suited, even in the unlikely event or remote likelihood of an event similar to what the failure was, that it could potentially break those lines, and it would be better to construct those out of stainless steel. And so these are a number of different fittings and valves and pipe pieces that at both pump stations. So I believe it's six different pumps at both pump stations. So it's three at each pump station, and quite a bit of stainless piping. So this was for labor and materials to swap out the plastic pipe to stainless at each one of the pump stations. And that's about $17,000 for that one. And I can answer any questions on any of the change orders before we move on to the two contract amendments.
And before we take questions, Paul, can you confirm that the change orders, the total in the amount of $124,700, are all within the contingency budget and require no additional funding?
That's correct. They require no additional funding to the overall WRF budget.
Thank you.
All right. Two slides ahead, and we can talk about the Waterworks engineers. I'll take Waterworks, and then if I could ask Mr. Heimel to answer any questions on RINCON and present that item. I was not in the lead on that, but have been well aware of what the Waterworks amendment is. Waterworks engineers is for an additional $40,000 for engineering services during construction. This is for requests for information, additional working with Anvil on design questions, and when issues come up, Anvil would ask us for how we work through those issues. So there's quite a bit of effort. And then, as the construction schedule extends, you end up with additional RFIs, and you end up with additional time spent on the project. So this was an additional $40,000 for Waterworks engineers to support the construction phase services for the conveyance facilities. And I can take any questions on that before I turn this over to Mr. Heimel for the RINCON amendment.
Are these budget or actual costs being added?
This is, in this particular case, this is actual costs. What Waterworks had done is they had some additional items. I believe in this case they had some additional scope items that they hadn't accomplished yet. So this is more or less reimbursing them for this work. We always have a choice whether we could de-scope them on some other items or add to it. In this case, we elected to add to their overall not to exceed amount.
Thank you.
This is Lori. I don't have a question, but I'm just looking at a copy of Amendment 7 for Anvil. And I just noted that there's a few dates of 2022, and I wanted to check if that was intentional or if maybe there's a typo in there.
Are you referring to the utility work, miscellaneous utility work, or are you?
It's the actual amendment. We were given the text.
Okay. Let me.
We can look into that and confirm if those dates are accurate.
Just something I noticed while we're sitting here enjoying your presentation. Thank you.
And then, Paul, can you let me know about that as well?
Yeah. We'll take a look at the amendment. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Any other comments from the board or questions?
I just have a curious question. And a lot of times, a lot of these things that we read through, it kept saying that exceeded the not to exceed cost. Is the not to exceed cost, how is that determined if you keep exceeding the not to exceed cost?
That's a great question, Advisory Board Member Goldman, and one that we often receive because the term not to exceed seems to imply it is unexceedable. however, the not to exceed cost is for a given scope. So, for example, if I ask, I like pizza, and if I ask for one pizza pie for a not to exceed of $20 and pay that amount, that's fine. But then if I go back and in the middle of that order and say, well, I'd also like a salad, well, now my not to exceed is going to increase. So our not to exceeds, whenever there are changes to them, it is because of a scope change that is required for the project.
That was required but not previously known until you got into the project? Is that
correct?
Any other questions? Okay, please proceed.
So I am not familiar with the RINCON. Oh, there's Dan. Okay, great. I will shut up.
Yeah, so just briefly here, I can cover the RINCON consultant contract. So as I believe the PWAB knows, this last year, the city received notification of an award of $9.3 million from the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation Title 16 Recycled Water Funding Program. And so that's and that funding, that $9.3 million, will help pay for it's up to 25% of the recycled water program component costs. And so that is obviously great news and will help reduce the overall program costs and the impact to ratepayers. However, in order to access that funding, the city needs to prepare a standalone NEPA, or National Environmental Protection Act, document for the recycled water facilities component of the project. And so this is a contract from RINCON Consultants to assist the city in the preparation of that NEPA document to access the grant funding.
And Dan, can you clarify whether the $43,352 is an eligible grant cost under that same grant?
I believe that it is.
Thank you.
Is that the only addition to the contract, just the NEPA compliance?
There's some additional just overall environmental compliance support included in that contract. As we progress with the design of the recycled water facilities, the program team felt that it would be beneficial to have specialized input from an environmental consultant as we navigate the design and construction of the recycled water facilities within the requirements of the original environmental document for the program.
It's a little uncommon because normally the purpose of the NEPA document is to make a decision before a project is actually constructed.
Yes, and so that is a little so, and that's kind of an interesting piece about the recycled water facilities. A portion of the project has been constructed in the advanced treatment facilities at the Water Resources Center and the advanced purified pipeline that conveys that recycled water to the Morro Basin. However, a significant portion of the recycled water facilities has yet to be constructed, and that is the additional injection wells as well as the pipelines to feed those injection wells with the advanced purified water. And so I think that and then just the partially of the timing of when this grant came through is why it's in that non-traditional scenario.
So does that mean that those other construction activities will pause until there's a final decision from the Bureau, or they proceed in any event?
No, I mean, those other construction activities, I mean, really at this point are largely complete, as Paul described. They are those treatment facilities. I guess if you're referring to what's already been constructed, as I described, or the
you said that parts of it had not been constructed.
Yes. Yeah, so they won't necessarily pause. They just aren't intended to initiate for about a year from now. So.
And who made the determination that an environmental assessment was needed in that first instance?
That was a direction from the Bureau of Reclamation that it's for the city to access this funding, they need to prepare an environmental assessment, a standalone environmental assessment. For the WIFIA funding, another federal funding source, the city was able to take advantage of a programmatic environmental or NEPA agreement that WIFIA had put in place, but this is another federal organization with its own requirements.
Yeah, but what I'm puzzling over is that the purpose of the NEPA document is to inform the decision, so in this instance the Bureau is deciding if they should provide the funding or not. If the project, how NEPA works is there's an analysis of no action, so that would be the Bureau not providing funding, or if the Bureau does provide funding, and then you look at the effects of those two alternatives. In this case, the effects are identical because the project's going to occur with or without that money, so I'm not understanding the purpose of the NEPA document.
Can I throw something in there? Is it because the fact that these additional four wells, or however many of you decided that we can, were not, you know, they were not part of the original contract, if I remember rightly, and that we're adding the work in order to install these wells, or did we have a fixed price for these wells, but they were in a location unknown?
Yeah, so all good questions. So, yeah, the four wells are not included in either of the current construction contracts with Anvil or FPV. So, yes, this is work to be designed, permitted, and then constructed in the future. This NEPA analysis would, to your point, you know, would evaluate constructing or not constructing those wells as a component of the project. It is a little bit awkward in that some of the recycled water facilities have already been constructed, and so there's really no going back on those components of the recycled water program. And so that's something that the program team is working with the Bureau of Reclamation on, and I would say that the city is not the only one dealing with that specific issue for this funding award. There are a number of other potable reuse projects that receive money through this award that are in construction or have facilities that already have been constructed but did request funding through this grant program for.
Okay, so just to clarify, and I'm sorry for belaboring this, but I just want to make sure that this is, you're getting the correct information from BOR. So you're saying that part of the project would not be constructed until the environmental analysis is complete?
If we want the grant funding.
And that part of the project would not be constructed without the grant?
That is correct.
Okay, that makes a little more sense. Thank you very much for your patience. Any other questions?
I have a question. You perhaps have to forgive me because I'm the newest member to the board, and some of my questions will strike people as probably fairly naive. But there was an interesting question that came up at yesterday's city council meeting where someone was questioning the utility of why the purified water from the plant is first injected into these wells and then removed and to be purified again. And I thought the response and rationale was these wells are essentially, or the aquifer that the wells connect is essentially a storage facility, and that's the major rationale for this whole secondary plan. Would I be correct in thinking that?
Partially. It acts as a storage facility. But the primary purpose of the aquifer in this indirect potable reuse concept is actually as a, and I guess storage is a good term for it, it's to provide a time buffer. So the concerns that the Division of Drinking Water, the public health regulators have with potable reuse projects is that if there is a potential upset of the advanced treatment system, they want to make sure that there is enough time that upset is detected and mitigated against before that water reaches somebody's tap. And so the regulations as written now for groundwater recharge and recovery programs is they want a minimum of 2 months residence time or response retention time in the groundwater basin such that the city staff would have 2 months to identify that there was an issue and address that issue before that water would get extracted and delivered to the customers of Morro Bay.
If I could put that in a layperson's term, and I consider myself such a layperson, the regulators wouldn't let us simply take the water purified from the plant, even though it's potable, mm-hmm. of a potable standard. They would not let us take that and serve it to our customers.
So the fact that the water, once the water is removed from the wells, and I guess it's purified again, that is really irrelevant. The additional cost of that additional purification is really irrelevant because you wouldn't be allowed to take that directly from the plant. That's what you're saying. Okay, very good. Thank you for that.
That is correct.
I had an odd thought. Will the amount of purified water coming out of the wharf exceed the capacity of these injection wells?
You know, so the program team is working on the final design of the injection wells. And so, you know, the number of those injection wells really will be designed around the amount of water available from the plant. So, you know, it could, but only, you know, by design. You know, if it was determined that it, you know, it wasn't necessary to capture all of that advanced purified water at this point in time, then we could construct an injection well field that didn't have capacity for all the water, or we could add a couple additional wells then to ensure that there was capacity to capture all of that water.
So the thought in my head was, is if the plant generates more water than we can inject, could we just let it discharge into Charro Creek and call it good?
Well, we don't, in theory, that's a possibility, but we don't have the infrastructure to do that. Mm-hmm. More likely is a scenario where we can either just sell that water, for example, to the golf course, or discharge it to the ocean. And I would like to make one point of clarification. Forgive me, this is going to sound very bureaucratic, but at a recent WRF subcommittee meeting, it was noted that there is some confusion in terms about the WRF. And so the water reclamation facility, often called the WRF, refers to the full program, which is the new plant, the conveyance facilities, and recycled water. The plant itself, however, is now called the Water Resources Center. That's the name that's in front of it. And so I would just ask, to the best of our ability, if we could remember to use the correct terms so as not to perpetuate that confusion. Was that clear? Thank you.
You can just continue to correct us. How about that?
I will do my best.
Is that the end of the presentation?
Yes.
Any other questions from the board?
Paul, do you have anything else?
I do not.
So then at this time, we would invite anyone who would like to make a public comment on any of those many, many topics that were discussed to please come forward to the podium. We do not appear to have public comment. Is any virtual attendee wish to comment?
There are no raised hands at this time.
Okay, thank you. We can conclude item A4 and then move on to item A5.
If I may, Chair Beal.
Yes.
We're certainly not looking for any formal recommendation, but I know that our city council is interested in hearing from the PWAB about these quarterly reports and the proposed change orders and or contract amendments. If there's any feedback that I can provide the City Council and our staff report to them about how this or what review this PWAB did of this presentation, and if there's any conclusions from the PWAB on it. And by that I mean specifically, is the PWAB concerned with any of the change orders and or contract amendments? Do they seem reasonable or some other opinion?
I have something. I think they sound reasonable, and I do get concerned about them, but they're all explained. All the change orders are explained so well that I don't know what you want us to say. We can't say, oh, I disagree with that, because it's already presented and taken care of. But I appreciate hearing about it and reading about it.
And I think at the last meeting that I attended, being the new member of the board, I had suggested that a little more information be contained in these amendments so that that someone who wasn't unfamiliar could make some conclusions. And I certainly, reading this file, I think those suggestions were taken. I had a much better understanding of the rationales behind each of the amendments than I did of the earlier ones. So thank you.
That's great feedback from both of you. Anyone else?
Yep. I found the package more than adequate to answer just about any of my questions except for the weird ones I just asked. And when I was doing my own project management for the Corps of Engineers, this is basically what I'd be looking for anyway, so it works very well.
Thank you. Anyone else?
When I was reviewing the bollards issue, the PG&E request for more bollards struck me as a bit of a concern, because initially we were going to have a facility there, and PG&E had an opportunity to comment at that time. What changed that made them want more bollards for protection to go in there?
It's a good question. Paul, can you respond to that?
That's a good question. I'm not sure I have a good, rational answer for that. What changed is that time passed and PG&E set the transformer and determined that they needed more bollards. I, as a person who works with PG&E quite a bit, they tend to change their mind and kind of shrug when you complain about it. It's unfortunate that occurs that way. But
Paul, do we know if the requirement to have bollards there is some standard that PG&E has, or is that an administrative decision made by folks out in the field from PG&E?
I think it's a combination of the two. It may be one of those vague requirements. I don't know the specific answer to that, Greg. It may be a vague requirement where they say protect transformer, and then PG&E ultimately does that design, where our designer may have felt that four bollards was adequate, and then PG&E does the design. Time passes between the time the original design and the construction, and then they come and set the transformer and believe, now that they look around at the site, that we need more.
Okay, I appreciate that answer, and if you wouldn't mind checking into that a bit for the report that goes to the City Council, we can note that this question was brought up by the PWAB and see what we come up with there.
Absolutely.
So we can give that information to the City Council.
Mr. Quout, just for my benefit, we've got to check the amendment for dates, right, and then check the bollard issue. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Okay, then now we will move on, concluding item A4 and moving on to item A5.
And, Lori, before we get onto that, I have to tell you that I have to recuse myself at this point because I am one of the property owners involved in this decision. So I will go sit in the audience, but I may participate as a citizen of the city.
Duly noted. Thank you, Jan. And I will note that we do still have a quorum, with Council Member Goldman recusing herself from this matter. So this has to do with installation of a red curb, and would staff like to explain that to us?
Sure. Chair Beal, I just would like to remind the advisory board that this is the first item that we are bringing to the advisory board that came out of an ad hoc committee of this board that looked at how we can make more transparent decisions about traffic, traffic engineering, striping, markings, stop signs, et cetera. We felt that the Public Works Advisory Board could be a forum for some of these decisions, and that we could invite neighbors that are immediately affected or impacted in the area of the suggested improvement. As you all know, the Public Works Department receives many requests to add stop signs, take away stop signs, stripe roads differently, et cetera. And so this, again, is the first item. A reminder that the Public Works Advisory Board does not direct work of the Public Works Department. That is the job of the city manager, who takes his or her direction from the city council. The Public Works Advisory Board's role is to advise council on such matters. However, what we're doing here is really opening up a forum, hearing an issue, hearing the analysis from the city engineer, and then hearing public comments from members of the public that are impacted by this issue. And what we are looking for at the end of that presentation is concurrence with staff's plan or disagreement or other inputs. And ultimately, staff will make our own decision about what we intend to do, and we wouldn't say that tonight, because depending on feedback we receive from the PWAB, we may require further analysis. But I do just want to mention that we are looking for concurrence on our plan, and we would be looking for a vote. So with that, I am going to pass it to our city engineer, Eric Riddio, for the first presentation.
Good evening. Thank you, Director Kwalik. So this item, there's two traffic items tonight. A5 relates to consideration of installation of red curb on Yerba Buena Street. The address is of 300 through 316. This is a multi-unit housing property. If you're familiar with Yerba Buena, right next to Main Street, just to the east, also just east of Highway 1. The city received a request to consider looking at this because of a concern of safety when there are numerous vehicles parked in this neighborhood during high tourism or mostly days when there's folks that go across the highway to the beach. This area can be congested with many cars. And given that Main being an arterial roadway and the highway just to the west, there is occurrences of vehicles traveling at higher speeds as they come into this residential area. So the request was to take a look at this as far as, is there a way to address concerns with vehicles that pull out of this driveway, as we have a slide up on the screen that shows the driveway just to the right. I do want to make clear that I think when the item was described as far as circulated and also the title of the item, the no parking zone, we weren't specific in that because we were refining that, but this isn't installing a no parking zone on that entire stretch. It's merely adding two 10-foot zones on either side of the driveway. Because of the number of residents who live in this facility, it's used frequently by them, and when there are cars parked right up on the driveway on either side, I did confirm that there is a line of sight issue, especially if vehicles are coming at higher speeds. And that's especially if there are larger vehicles, that would make that even more of a line of sight issue. I did receive several phone calls about this, and I did clarify our intent was not to install red curb up and down, but just in 10 feet on either side. There was also some feedback about installing new painted curb and a reference to other painted curb areas that are maybe have been not maintained. So that has been noted that we do need to make sure that this is something that will be maintained in the future. We need to look at the red curb areas that we have in the city and assess maintenance needs. So that is something we have taken into consideration as well. But I do feel that this will assess the will address the line of sight issue at this location. And also, as you get into the residential areas, deeper into the neighborhood, there's still line of sight issues for individual driveways, but being that this is a multi-unit facility and it's close proximity to the highway, that's why this was considered for this. So I'm happy to answer any questions that you have on this item.
Eric, I have a question. Looking at a different image that's on my phone map, I see that there's a big water valve assembly next to the back of the Suburban in the landscaped area there. Is there also a fire hydrant access point in that water valve assembly that the fire department would want access? Or would our maintenance team need access to that valve assembly in random situations, and having some vehicle parking buffer there would help to access that?
That's a good question. As far as there is no hydrant in the bush there that I'm aware of. Typically those will be indicated by a pavement marker in the roadway. As far as for the unit itself, there's probably a valve closer to the unit for fire to access. As far as accessing the meters themselves, typically it's the meter reader service or that would be accessing those, and that can be done from walking on the sidewalk. However, if there is work that needs to be done in the street to service that, then typically on an emergency basis they would have to post no parking to do that work, but I don't believe there is any immediate need to actually install the paint for that purpose. We have a lot of connections into city water mains that we have to service, and this would not be unique.
Eric, if you don't mind, I just have a few general questions since this is the first such project we've kind of talked about. Like, this is selected out of a list of, like, how many roughly comparable requests?
So we have a growing number of traffic items on the list that I have kept, many of the items on that list will require some additional engineering, so maybe some outside consulting assistance. A lot of the items on that list also will be addressed when we do our local roadway safety plan, which is something that is coming this fiscal year. As far as the local roadway safety plan is a plan that is necessary to for the city to put together to be able to apply for highway safety improvement grants from Caltrans and other grant programs. The focus of that plan will be addressing safety of vehicles, of pedestrians, of cyclists, and we'll be looking at speed, we'll be looking at traffic calming, and a lot of other bigger picture items as far as traffic goes. So I think some of those items will be coming later, but we want to have that plan and the community outreach piece done before we address any of those. So,
so just generally, like out of roughly comparable projects that wouldn't be on hold due to the roadway improvements or that wouldn't require additional engineering, I'm just curious how many of those you would be looking at any one time. Like how many do you have right now?
We probably have at least 20 to 30. There's probably another three or four of these parking-related items that have been brought to our attention. There are many others that have been either emailed or called in where we get back to the party with a decision that it's clear what the decision is, whether it can be accommodated or not, or if it requires additional analysis. For example, we had a recent request for installation of an ADA spot in the city, and it was determined it was on a slope street, and it had it was close to a curb ramp, but a non-compliant curb ramp, so it didn't really make sense at that time to install an ADA spot. And the building itself already had an ADA spot in the back parking lot, which was a little bit further from the entrance of the property. But and so those type of situations that do not require an actual install, those type of situations we make a decision based on analysis that we are confident in performing.
And so the 20 or 30 that you mentioned, out of those, how many are comparable to this in that they wouldn't be looked at in the LRSP or wouldn't require additional engineering?
I can certainly look into that. I don't know off the top of my head, but just a handful. I think a lot of the traffic items that are, I would say, in the queue are related to speed, which, again, I remind folks, we're in the middle of doing our citywide speed survey currently. We're about 90% through the data collection of that, and we'll be hoping to give an update on that in March at our PWAP. Traffic calming is probably the number one as far as requests for speed humps, speed bumps, some kind of traffic calming, mini traffic circles, those kind of things, which I think our LRSP and will help us to guide us to make decisions on those type of items instead of ruling or making decisions when we don't really have a policy on how we, in looking at those things. Because, speed humps require maintenance. Speed humps are not something the city has looked at in the past. So if we're going to be looking at those type of measures, then we need to be consistent in how we implement them and look at them.
Yes, that's great. Thank you, Eric. Is the 10-foot, is that sort of the standard that you would use to protect a driveway entrance?
I looked into that. It can be as little as 5, but I've seen it in some other cities do 12 feet. 10 foot is, in looking around the city, like on if we're looking at the next item, Morro Bay Boulevard has a lot of areas where there's red curb near the corners. And in some cases it was 5, some cases it was 10. And I think that's seemed to be to provide adequate line of sight. I mean, there's other concerns at this property with, you know, the hedge that's there in the corner at the right. That needs to be maintained at a certain height to keep a good line of sight as well. But so, yeah, I don't know if that answers the question.
Are the other properties you've looked at residential or commercial?
Mostly commercial. I mean, this really is entering into a residential off of, you know, Main Street. So I think when you go into the residential, it's a little bit different how you would attack these type of situations.
My thought with commercial would be that it might be a one-time visitor versus a residential where the visitor is a regular user and would have knowledge of the accessibility and line of sight. So I think there's a difference between the two.
I think the issue, I like those cars doing 45 through that intersection. It's just, I mean, they haul. They're coming off Highway 1, and they do not slow down until they have to.
I'm curious, too, has there been any accidents there that we know of ever?
I didn't find record of any accidents at that location, but...
Because I would think more of the intersection down by the light is probably the more dangerous, but, you know, I've never heard of anything right there. And is there adequate, like, parking for the apartment? Or is it, like, mainly people that live there parking there? Because I don't see a lot of beachgoers parking there and crossing the freeway.
I've seen quite a few.
Well, maybe, like, on the 4th of July, but...
Yeah, I mean, on weekends, that is a place that they use a lot.
Yeah, I think most of the folks that park there or live in the neighborhood. I checked with planning as far as is there any... mandatory on-street parking as far as part of that development, and there was none. It was all on-site parking, so it would be probably visitors for that complex and neighbors that live across the street or on the block somewhere. So, but I have seen, you know, when it's usually for holidays or. You know, parts of the year when it's more attractive to go to the beach, that the overflow would come over to that side of the freeway because people do want to tend to park on Beachcomber and don't want to have to walk. So,
and then if you did have a similar situation but that had a history of safety incidents, I assume you would prioritize the one that actually had documented safety concerns?
Absolutely, yes.
Yeah, thanks. Any other questions?
No, it looks reasonable to me, and I concur with what Eric has come up with.
Do we have anyone from the public that would like to comment at this time?
As a public person only here, on that drawing, that red right there closest to us is actually on a curve that comes around to Main Street where there's a stop sign. But when you're I live in that area, and when I come out of my driveway, if a car is parked on that curb, I can't see around it. I can't see if anything is coming on Main Street. I can see if they're coming off of the freeway, but I can't see if they're coming around on Main Street. And if a car is parked on the other side in the red thing, I have the same issue. So I have to pull way out, almost a car's length, out of my driveway to look up Yerba Buena and to see if there's a car. And if I'm looking the other way, I mean, then I start to pull out, and then there's suddenly a car coming around the corner. And like yesterday, there were two service vehicles parked there, one on each side of the driveway, which really limited my sight, what I could see. Now, granted, I sit in a low car. I have a little car. But other residents who live in the place have told me that they have the same issue, and their cars are all taller than mine. So I've really been noticing it. And another thing, the people who live there, we all park in our carports. I think if I park on the street, it's because I have to run in for something and come back out. It's never for very long. So generally speaking, the residents there do park in the carport. The problem is getting out onto the street safely. And that was the whole big thing. And especially on this corner, the first one close to us, since that is on a curve and people are coming around the corner, and it's just really, it's just difficult. Thank you.
I have another question related to that, sorry to belabor it, but is it legal to park on a curve like that, a curb?
That's what I've wondered also as I've peeked out there around.
And I'm sorry, I would recommend that we complete the public comment portion of the item before we take more questions for staff.
I'm also a resident of the condos, and I've been there now with my wife and I about 10 years now, full-time resident of Morro Bay. And it is, in the last 4 or 5 years, become more and more of a hazard trying to get out onto the highway, out on the street. Traffic has increased considerably over the years. Of course, summertime, and most weekends, there's considerable more traffic on this road. The other problem is when we come out of our driveway, we're at a little bit of a slant coming up to get to the curb, but definitely looking east, it's extremely difficult to see around a small vehicle, but a truck, pickup truck or anything like that, it's definitely a hazard. So you have to inch your way out to see what's coming. The other problem is the speed of the vehicles coming down Tierra Buena, especially when the light changes, that intersection, they tend to pick up their speed to try to make the light. And so this adds an additional danger to it. Plus, you have the cars coming around on Main Street, turning, going up Yerba Buena, and at the same time, you have vehicles coming off of Highway 1 coming up Yerba Buena. The additional problem is the vehicles stopping to go across Highway 1. When the signal's red, they sometimes back up into the intersection there. So the cars coming off that have to swerve around them and then come up Yerba Buena. So I feel it's definitely a hazard for us when we're pulling out of that, and it's just an accident waiting to happen because the traffic has continued to become heavier and heavier.
Also, you didn't mention people not stopping at the stop sign on Main Street. I've seen that happen enough.
Happens also.
It's not an ideal intersection.
Thank you.
Do we have any additional public comments from our audience members here? And yes, please.
Hi. So I do not live in that condo complex. My house is just slightly out of view on this picture. I do sometimes park on that sidewalk. It's 20 feet from my driveway. I have four people living in my house, so we sometimes do have to share. We do not park there for an extended time unless something like the storm, where that's preventing us from safely leaving our homes. I wasn't really aware originally that it was just going to be excuse me, 10 feet on each side. Just from the information, it just sounded like it was going to block that whole sidewalk. And I do appreciate my neighbor's safety concerns because it's the right thing to do. We all are cordial with each other. But there is a problem with parking on that sidewalk. I do notice that, like someone else mentioned, ServPro, gardeners, and multiple other services and what have you do park there. So it's just a little difficult of what to say, what to do. I personally didn't notice any, like, trying to pull out into the street. I've personally never had any issues, but that's just my standpoint. I cannot discount my neighbors and what happened to them. It is true that most of the accidents that do happen are at the stoplight when somebody doesn't stop accordingly at the streetlight, and sometimes really scary things happen. It's just, it's conflicting. There are people who live in that condo complex who do have family parking there, so other residents who live on this other side of the street do share parking. Nobody's really greedy about it. We all would like to just find a solution that would make everyone happy, and that's pretty much my piece on it. I do have other conflicts regarding that, but it doesn't seem relevant to this meeting. I also have a letter from one of the residents who could not make it here today. I'm unsure if I could present the letter to somebody here.
You can give it to me.
Okay. But that's pretty much it. I'm not here to debate with issues with other neighbors, but it's just a concern that we all have because we don't really see that big of a problem. But again, I can't speak for someone else's safety concern.
Thank you. Do we have any other public comments? I don't believe there are any other comments from members or from community members here. Do we have anyone virtual that would like to comment?
There is no raised hands at this time.
Okay.
And Chair Beal, may I read this comment that was provided for the advisory board?
Yes. Is that the email or the additional letter that you have?
This is an additional letter that was just given to me. And this is an individual whose name is Dr. Richard Starrett. He says, historically, both sides of Yerba Buena are designated for public parking. If the owner of the property is not parked in front of their property, anyone can park there. Visitors, out-of-area family, service workers, public works, delivery, repair, maintenance, lawn service people, and local residents use the public parking areas. Most visitors park short-term, some service people by day, and a few people overnight and leave the next morning. There is no one trying to sell their vehicles or long-term parking problems. If 300 to 316 Yerba Buena Street is designated no parking, why should the rest of the residents not also have the same destination? In addition, why should the rest of the neighborhood bear the additional burden of having all the additional vehicles that would park in 300 to 316 parking in front of our property? There is not enough parking available on Yerba Buena the way it is. Why add additional burden on the local residents? This action can be seen as biased, unjust, discriminatory, and a conflict of interest by the newly elected council person living in these units. Signed.
And Mr. Kwolek, I would note that we did receive another comment via email. Would that be part of our record already? Do we need to address that?
Thank you for the question. Chair Beal, if that was added to the advisory board correspondence, then no, because that information is public. That letter is public already, and I'm getting a head nod from Janine that yes, it is included in the correspondence, which is included in the agenda packet.
Okay. Was there any other public comment? I believe I just want to verify there was no one virtual.
Correct. There are no raised hands at this time.
Okay. Any further questions from the board?
Just one more. did staff survey the potential benefits of the 10-foot no parking? In other words, stand out there and create some kind of visual barrier and see what the benefits would be of 10 feet versus, say, 5 feet or 15?
No, we did not do an actual in-the-field assessment of that. I think the intent with 10 feet, it was kind of a minimum to see if that provides added line of sight for folks coming out. We do realize that parking is a great concern in the neighborhood. I did receive several calls about that, so I think our thought was to keep it to a minimum as far as elimination of parking, but yet, in my opinion, the 5 feet just didn't seem like it would provide enough line of sight.
And I would add that there's sort of a level of effort question on some of these items that come to us. There are certainly some parking questions that might require in-depth study and possibly engineering. This feels a bit more like a field call. And when coupled with public input, a call that, you know, we can make just based on or on some sort of reasonable standard. And I say that because it probably would not be possible for the staff to complete an in-depth analysis of every item, just because we don't have the capacity or the resources to do that. So there will be these sorts of items where if they're relatively minor alterations or simple, such as, you know, 10-foot red curb, we'll just make a call.
The concern of speed on Yerba Buena caught my ear, and I wonder if the suggestion has been entertained that a crosswalk across Yerba Buena parallel to Main Street might slow down traffic a bit through there.
That is a great point. There is a Caltrans pavement rehab project for Highway 1 where they will be upgrading ADA facilities at the corners. And I think that would be an opportune time for the city to also do, to come over to Main Street. And they have extended that. If we have requests or if we have added work, that we could essentially put it in their contract, we would be responsible for paying for it, but we could get the advantage of a large project, the pricing to put in curb ramps and potentially even stripe, you know, crosswalks at that intersection, because there is no sidewalk on that stretch of Main. It terminates just to the south. So we do have a goal of infilling gaps where there are gaps in walkable surfaces, so sidewalks and certainly crosswalks, because of the draw to the beach and for the neighborhood, you know, for folks to get safely there is of concern.
As you noted, the Caltrans project coming would be refreshing the crosswalk that's on the northerly side of the Yerba Buena crossing of Highway 1. So getting pedestrians across Yerba Buena before they even get to Highway 1 might be a benefit for the pedestrian safety.
Yes, so we had requested Caltrans to put in high visibility crosswalks there. Currently it's a standard crosswalk, which is basically the two lines, and the high vis would have more of a ladder style or a continental style. But we would expand and look at, you know, making connectivity to the sidewalk, and if there are curb ramps installed, then it would make sense at that point to put a crosswalk in.
Eric, one final question. One of the public commenters mentioned that parking might be obscured by service vehicles or larger truck vehicles. Do we know if that complex provides parking for entities that come to provide services at that location? In other words, if their trucks are blocking their own view, maybe there's something they can do to reduce that issue. And just one final comment. Based on the comments we heard, a little bit pro, maybe a little bit concern, a little bit con, one consideration could be to shorten that red strip that's at the farther end in the photograph, as that does not seem quite as much of a safety issue, whereas you can see with the part where the street is actually curved around, you know, that seems reasonable to restrict parking there.
So to answer your question about service vehicles, I don't believe there's parking on site that would be available for service vehicles to the complex. I would imagine it's just the carports and that's it. So any service vehicles would have to park on the street.
Anything else on this topic?
It strikes me that the red stripe is 10 feet. Doesn't seem at all arbitrary. On the contrary, it seems like it's relying on professional experience. I could summarize the people that I've heard so far as opposed to it. It basically centers on one of convenience and a kind of a sense of fair access to public space. But I really think that it gets trumped by a concern for physical safety, and I think there's been an adequate demonstration that there's some risk to personal safety here, so I have no problem with making either side of the curb red.
Unless there's anything else, we will close.
I would like to note that one of the comments submitted was as if the whole length of curb in front of the building was going to be marked no parking. But if I understand correctly, Eric, you're only talking about 10 feet by the 10 feet by the driveway. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. It'd be 10 feet to the west of the driveway and 10 feet to the east.
So if my eye tells me right, there's probably about, 100 feet from the driveway to the property line of that condo, which would normally be 5 parking spaces, maybe 4, and taking 10 feet and assuming that there's another 5 feet between the end of the parking and the next driveway, they're not losing a parking space, so they should be considered whole parking.
Yeah, for typical parking spaces, they're 20 feet in length. So, I mean, this could be 2 small vehicles or 1 large vehicle if you were looking at how much parking has been eliminated.
But we're talking a 10-foot, so we don't let cars park in front of driveways anyway. So.
And I would remind members of the advisory board, as well as the chair, that staff is looking for a motion of either concurrence or some other input that we could take away from this item.
I move to concur with the recommendation for the 10 feet of no parking on either side of the driveway.
I second that.
Advisory Board Member Ingraffio.
Yes, I approve.
Advisory Board Member Irwin.
Yes.
Advisory Board Member Gaffney.
Yes.
Advisory Board Member Nava.
Yes.
Chair Beal.
No.
And I will note that Advisory Board Member Goldman has recused herself from voting for this item. So we had 4 yeas, 1 nay. And 1 recusal.
So now we will move on to agenda item A6, which is another colored curb issue. We Would staff like to explain this agenda item, please?
Yes. A6 is consideration of removal of red curb. So this is actually putting more parking. And this is in front of the 698 Morro Bay Boulevard. The intersection of Morro Bay Boulevard and Piney Way is an all-stop controlled intersection with standard crosswalks. There are four other all-way stops up and down Morro Bay Boulevard, including the intersection at Main Street. We reviewed the red curb lengths at those various intersections, and they range from 5 to 30 feet, depending on different circumstances. In some cases, where there was 30 feet or longer stretches of red curb was usually due to the presence of a fire hydrant or a short a fire hydrant coupled with a driveway immediately after. So it would make sense why there was entire red curb at a location with a close proximity of a fire hydrant. A request was received by the city to explore the possibility of reducing the red curb length at 698 Morro Bay Boulevard and add another parking space. Request was received from the city to explore this possibility. The current red curb length is 30 feet, and there is no fire hydrant. The fire hydrant is on the opposite side of the street. What we'd be looking at is reducing that 30 feet to 10 feet so that one parking space may be added. Reducing the length of red curb, and the parking space that would be added would be painted green, which is a limited time parking. Now, as far as limited time, that's another issue that I think is for a future advisory board meeting, because there seems to be different time lengths, and I think, myself included, folks are at times don't know what the green curb means, like down on Embarcadero and other places. Is it 2 hours? Is it 30 minutes? But the idea is that it's a limited time, so it's not meant to be a long-term parking spot. In this case, as with the Yerba Buena item, folks within is it 500 feet? 500? Within 300 feet of the location were notified of the proposed change, and that would be discussed at this meeting. So I wanted to make that clear as far as notification. I've reviewed this request, and looking at the other intersections, again, they're all stop. So I did receive some phone calls about concerns of safety of people crossing at this location. With it being an all-way stop, it is the law to stop and to look. And reducing to 10-foot still provides that line of sight for vehicles even, and for pedestrians that are coming to, are preparing to cross. I don't believe it would make sense to extend parking all the way up to the curb ramp. However, that is, as I've looked in other areas of the city, is there are locations where the car parking goes right up to the curb ramp. So my proposal would be that we keep 10 feet of red curb that's already there to about where the the city waste cans are, and then paint green for the remaining red curb. Can you advance to the next slide? Is it? There we go. So that shows the red curb that would remain and the green parking space that would be added. So we recommend that the Public Works Advisory Board concur with the proposed plan to remove red curb, no parking, and replace with green curb. Again, that's to replace, to leave 10 feet and to add 20 feet of green in this location. So at this time, I'll entertain any questions.
Eric, I'm just curious why you would, or what's the rationale for a green curb versus just, you know, regular unlimited parking spot?
I did receive a phone call from someone concerned about long-term parking in this location. The facility or the on the corner there, the I think it's a dance studio or has you know, often has drop-offs and you know, it seems like having a limited time parking location would suit that location. I'm not opposed to, you know, just having it standard without the green, but I felt like that was a compromise for to address the concern of having cars just parked there for long term of time.
With the idea of drop-offs, does the city have any other loading zones that are striped accordingly?
This would not be a loading zone by its being a green curb. It's more, it's a limited time parking. Loading zone is typically for passenger loading is painted white. There are areas where we do have loading zones. I know down by the Embarcadero there are a few. And then as far as freight unloading, that's a yellow curb. So I don't believe that that would be adequate for this. So I think in this case, the green curb, you know, there is more green curb further down Morro Bay Boulevard. This is not, there aren't a green curb up in this block that I know of. So it would be the only spot that has a green curb.
So the street that turns to the right off of Morro Bay Boulevard, that there could be some residential parking along there, but not on Morro Bay Boulevard. It's largely a commercial area?
Yes, it is.
So overnight parking would not necessarily be needed out there on Morro Bay Boulevard? Hence the green curb.
Yes, that would be the thought with this, is that it would discourage overnight parking.
Would you continue? Is there any talk of continuing the green curb all the way to the next driveway?
That has not been entertained, but certainly something to consider.
The only thing that I'm kind of confused on is people park there right now anyway, and a green curb isn't being enforced anywhere else in the city, so I don't know why we would even think that's necessary right now. Could always paint it green when we do want to enforce that, I would say.
I'll jump in on that. It's a good call out. I think from our perspective, you know, the Public Works Department doesn't have control over enforcement, so we're really looking at policy questions related to how we treat parking around the city and what's right. From our standpoint, but also in consideration of the requests that we're receiving. And so I do appreciate that thought, but still we have to make a decision here about the request, regardless of, you know, whether or not it will be enforced.
I would lean towards more green and not an unpainted curb there. If you're going to mark one spot green, the spot adjacent to it should also be green. If there's no difference between the two.
You're talking, excuse me, Robert. Do you mean then to make the green go all the way to the driveway down that south of there?
Right.
Yeah.
So that there is one spot that is not different than the other spot. They should be the same.
So they'd have two. Is that spot that's left between the green and the driveway, is that long enough to be a parking spot?
It is.
Yes, it currently is a parking spot, but it's not painted. So
well,
that's certainly something we can consider looking at. If we're going to paint this, then be consistent with it at that location.
There's often a trailer parked there for days. I walk by there a lot.
I was going to make the same comment. I walk by there frequently, and there's very often a utility truck and a trailer attached to that. That's there for considerable amounts of time each day and on a regular basis. So, in fairness, it might be nice to have a green curb and make some threat of enforcement, right, if not actual enforcement.
I'd like to just go back to my comment that, you know, I'm realizing maybe I misspoke. I'm not aware of any parking patrols that the city does. However, if someone were to call in a parking violation, that the police department would certainly respond to that and enforce that. So that's obviously a lot easier to do on a green curb than on a curb that's not painted, because I think someone has 72 hours before they have to be removed. Whereas on the green curb, it's what's posted there. And on a red curb, you know, they're not allowed to park there at all. So I just wanted to point that out.
So may I ask, who made, did this request come from the business owner from the dance studio there?
Yes, it did.
So there's a concern that they need a place to drop people off and pick people up, is the assumption?
It wasn't disclosed what the purpose was. It was just that parking is a problem in the area, and the question was why is there all this red curb? We need more parking in downtown and in front of my business as well. So
they just want to park. Real quick follow-up, because you were talking about enforcement. Would enforcement of the green curb require the placement of signs indicating the time limit, and if so, is that a Public Works Department issue, or is that an enforcement issue?
That is certainly a Public Works Department issue. It's a good question. What I heard from City Engineer Radio is that how long of a time frame would be posted is something that would require a bit more analysis and something that we would determine. Partially based on the nature of the request, but also to be in conformance with other green curbs around town. We don't want to make up a new, you know, time limit or something like that. So those are the kinds of considerations we'd be looking at.
Any further questions from the board? I don't see any further comments. Anyone in the public like to make a comment at this time? Does not appear to be public comment. Anyone virtually attending would like to comment?
We have no raised hands in the queue.
Okay, thank you. And now, were you looking for a motion on this one?
Yes.
I would move to concur in the city's proposal.
I would second that.
And roll call vote, Advisory Board Member Ingrafia.
Yes.
Advisory Board Member Goldman.
Did we just concur to only make it 10,
30 and 10 feet? I mean,
oh, that's a good clarification.
10 and 20, because I would like to make it the 10-foot red and then green to the driveway.
Who made the original motion?
I did, and I framed it in terms of agreeing with the recommendation of the department.
So there is a motion then on the floor. Is there a second to that motion?
To which one? To make it?
Yes, to Chair Beal's motion.
Meaning the 10 feet of existing green and the 10 feet of existing red and 20 feet of green. That's the present motion?
Correct. That's the present motion.
I would second that.
Okay, so we have a motion and a second. Is anyone suggesting to amend the motion?
Yeah, personally, I don't think we need to just paint it white or whatever, so we just have less maintenance at that point there. Just keep the red where you show the red, and it just add another parking space. This is the only thing I would frame as.
Are you saying to, can you repeat that?
I would say that rather than add a green marked parking space, which requires maintenance, just add a parking space. And if Public Works decides that they should be green, we can leave that up to Public Works.
I believe we have at least two, perhaps three different motions. I'm going to begin by withdrawing my original motion to clear the decks a little bit here.
Okay.
I will second Mr. Irwin's.
Well, I would encourage the advisory board to have some discussion, because it sounds like there's, you know, two or three separate ideas out there, and it might be worth it to do that before we kind of have one final decision there.
Okay.
Well, I would just repeat, my recollection is that particular stretch of curb is very often occupied by one vehicle in particular, and I would think that painting it green would discourage that and make it more available to a variety of people wanting to use the space.
Painting it green, if you could clarify, as pictured in the presentation from the department, or painting the longer piece green?
I would say painting it green as depicted there, roughly 20 feet.
The one parking space. And then, Eric, were you saying that that additional space that Robert was talking about is about another 20 feet? Is that correct?
Yes, it's another full parking space.
Okay.
I would amend that. I would keep the red where it is, the 10 feet, but make all of the rest green all the way down to the driveway, only because you were talking about cars parked there, and it would be easier to maybe report them or to have traffic enforcement if it were green. If it's just a regular curb, they have 72 hours that they can park there. Is that right?
Yeah, if it's not marked, then the standard municipal code is 72 hours.
72 hours. So it would, in my mind, if you painted it all green, the 10-foot red and the rest is green, that it would eliminate the issue of somebody parking there overnight or all day.
The scenario that we're seeing now could change next month. There could be a new business in there, so it's hard to base a decision on one vehicle. And the bigger picture is, would we be adding more maintenance concerns and more enforcement concerns to a situation that can change next month?
Yeah. So could I change my thing? I would say add a parking space. And keep the red curb as shown. Add a parking space, and any color of the curb would be up to the Public Works Department to determine. Because it really isn't. It is not important. I would like to make a motion that the new motion is maintain the design of 10 feet of red parking. add a parking space, and the type of parking will be left up to the determination of the Public Works Department.
I would second that motion.
Agreed.
This is good. Advisory Board Member Ingraffia.
Yes, I.
Advisory Board Member Goldman. Advisory Board Member Irwin.
Yes.
Advisory Board Member Gaffney.
Yes.
Advisory Board Member Nava.
Yes.
And Chair Beal.
Yes.
Thank you. And I just want to say that, you know, this is a learning process for us. These are the first two that we've done. And as we're going through it, I think we're kind of learning things, and we may make adjustments in how we present certain things. So I do appreciate your patience with that.
So we are now on to agenda item B, which is future agenda items. We have listed here the Franklin Riley Park Tree Maintenance Plan, Cayucas Morro Bay Bike Path Connector Project, Tree Ordinance Update, Sidewalk Repair Project Presentation. Do any board members wish to propose additional items or have comments?
I would propose we add a status item for the FEMA recovery process.
Well, to broaden that, I believe maybe a few additional items in some of the upcoming meetings about the stormwater plan. I wouldn't want to devote an excessive amount of time to it necessarily at the next meeting, and we're coming up on some drier months. The funding certainly is pertinent and time sensitive, but in terms of being now interested to know the future of the stormwater management plan, the repairs and the things you talked about, floodplain management issues, I would be interested in having those at future meetings, not necessarily just in March.
Thank you for that. That is something we can bring to the PWAB. The first two there that are listed have to come in March for different reasons. And so we'll think about when to place those other two items on the agenda.
Anyone else?
If I could add one, I'd be really interested in an inventory of the assets when it comes to storm drain. The concern about being able to treat a corrugated metal pipe before it fails sounds like a big cost savings for the city if we had an inventory to start prioritizing, much like the pavement management. That would be helpful to be able to consider.
Thank you for that. And are you looking for a list of assets?
A list of assets and condition, but I understand that takes underground.
It does, and we do. So we do have the list of assets. We have it in our GIS system, and we may be looking at an option to do some cameraing of the storm drains. I'm not sure if we have the budget to do that, but. Are you suggesting to bring the idea back to the PWAB for discussion, or to bring the results back to PWAB for discussion?
It sounds like there is an inventory in GIS. If the city has a sense for, if city staff has a sense for hotspots or upcoming priorities, that would be helpful to be able to consider in terms of management of the assets.
Thank you.
And again, on the stormwater, not necessarily in any near term, but longer term, I'd be interested if there is a possibility to evaluate some larger scale resiliency projects, detention, et cetera, things of that nature.
Certainly something we can look at. I may reach out to you with some questions about that offline.
Well, I noticed where the ducks decided to have a duck pond and thought, maybe we should just have a pond. And with that, unless anyone has anything further, I would like to thank everyone for their participation today, members of the public and the board, and thank Public Works for their excellent presentations as usual, and also thanks to our audio visual team support. And the meeting is now adjourned. Thank you.